Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. It seemed like any other morning. Her father woke up, showered, and shaved, picked up the newspaper at the end of the driveway. But instead of heading to work, he walked upstairs to his study, closed the door, and shot himself. For his family, his death was a tragedy. For his daughter, Joan Wickersham, it was also a mystery. In her new memoir, she attempts to unravel it, asking why her beloved father killed himself. This hour On Point, a father's suicide and the unanswered questions it left behind. Joining me now in the studio this hour is Joan Wickersham. She's an award-winning short story writer and author of the novel The Paper Anniversary. Her new memoir out today is called The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order. You can read an excerpt from the book at our new website, onpointradio.org. Joan Wickersham, it's so nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
So this book, I just want to say at the top, is not the complete downer you might imagine, given the title and the subject matter. There's so many nuances about family life and relationships. It's quite riveting, I must say. And we'll get to a lot of that in this hour, but I'd like you to start first off by telling us what happened.
My father died in 1991, and it was out of the blue as far as I was concerned and as far as the other members of my family were concerned. We saw him as a very calm, kind, tolerant, witty, elegant, you know, loving man. And he was very reserved and he was very private about his feelings. And we knew that he had some things going on in his life that were not easy to deal with. But nobody had any idea of the kind of despair that he must have been feeling. And so his death came as a complete shock to everybody. And yet, going through it later and trying to piece together what must have happened, I found that there were, in fact, clues. And I think your characterizing it as a mystery is exactly how it seemed to me. And that was really the impetus for writing this book, was to really try to explore the mystery in all of its complexity. You know, that I didn't want my father to be one day this full, complete, complex human being, and then the next day he was a suicide. And it felt like it had diminished him down to one word. And part of what I wanted to do was, yes, explore his suicide, but also restore him in all of his complexity as a full human being.
So read to us, would you, from the book. This is the very beginning of the book, from the very first chapter. The last moments, maybe, what was going through his mind before he killed himself.
Yeah, and I'd like to start this by saying that this was a particularly challenging kind of book to write. It didn't lend itself to straight memoir because I was trying to imagine things from all different viewpoints. And so this is really an attempt to just be inside my father's head. The book is organized as an index. It's called the Suicide Index, and so this is the very first entry, which is called Suicide, Act of, Attempt to Imagine. In the airport, coming home from vacation, he stops at a kiosk and buys grapefruits, which he arranges to have sent to his daughters. They will stumble over the crates waiting on their porches when they get home from his funeral. It's the last week of his life. Does he know that? At some point, yes. At the moment when his index finger closes on the trigger of the gun, he knows it with certainty. But before that, even a moment before, when he sat down in the chair holding the gun, was he sure? Perhaps he's done this much before, once or many times, held the gun, loaded the gun, but then stopped himself. No. When does he know that this time he will not stop? What about the gun? Has it been an itch, a temptation, the hidden chocolates in the bureau drawer? Did he think about it daily? Did it draw him? Did he have to resist it? Some days the gun sings to him. Other days, more often, he doesn't hear it. Maybe, on those stronger days, he has considered getting rid of it. Take it to a gun shop. Turn it into the police. But then someone else would know he has a gun. And it's no one else's business. He hasn't wanted to deal with their questions. Where did you get it? How long have you had it? Besides, how long has he had it? 20 years? 25? And never fired it in all that time? So where's the danger? What's the harm in keeping it around, letting it sleep there among the sweaters? He doesn't even know where the bullets are, for God's sake. But immediately, involuntarily, he does know. He knows exactly which corner of which drawer. We have to watch him from the outside. He leaves no clues. His whole life is a clue.
You bring up the irony in the book that your father actually disapproved of suicide, didn't he? I mean, you say in the book, you quote him as saying, you can't throw away your life no matter how hard it gets. It's all you've got.
Yeah, I think that that's... That again is one of the paradoxes and one of the mysteries of my father's death, is that he did have these very firmly held principles, and yet the last act he did completely contradicted all of those principles. And I don't really have an explanation for that. And I think part of what I try to acknowledge in this book is, after a suicide, you have this urge to get these definitive answers to the question why. You're left with all of these whys. The one person who could possibly have answered them isn't there anymore. He's taken himself away. And frankly, if you got him back, he might be full of contradictions still himself. And so I needed to acknowledge how complicated that is.
And that was part of what was so wrenching, I guess, and to read your thoughts as you tried to figure out why he had done this. You needed to be able to point to something. Ah, that's it. Now we know. And that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. I mean, there's one point in the book where I talk about adding up the reasons. You know, my father had business problems. He had health problems, nothing life-threatening, but just, you know, sort of things that wore on him for years. He had some other personal issues.
And maybe the money, you know, maybe it was some business deal gone bad.
Yeah, business deal gone bad, a loan that the bank called, which he couldn't repay, the issue of family money that got lost, comparing himself to other people, all those things. And yet I say at one point in the book, I think that you can take all the reasons and you can add them up, but I don't get the same answer my father did when he did the same piece of math. In other words, you can see some of the reasons why he did it, but it doesn't add up to a good, satisfying reason when a daughter looks at her father's suicide. It doesn't make me say, oh, okay, now I understand why he did it and it all makes sense. I still feel like, hey, that's still not, it still doesn't make sense.
To that point, read another section of the book about trying to figure out why.
Yeah, this is a section where I'm writing in a period that's really just a couple of days after my father died. In one sense, I knew exactly why my father had done it. I felt as if I were standing on a mountaintop, looking down at the entire topography of his life, a landscape of hurts and failures and physical ailments and disgraces and shames and exhaustion and hopelessness that was suddenly, from this new high vantage point that had become accessible only with his death, fully visible for the first time. I realized already, looking back at the moment yesterday morning when I had first learned of his death, that in addition to my genuine disbelief, I had also known that what I was being told was true, had known it so deeply and clearly that his suicide didn't even seem like news. It felt like something I'd known about for a long time, which was only now being confirmed by an official source. At the same time that I'd been thinking, oh no, I had also thought, of course.
So how do you reconcile, as a daughter, those two very contradictory reactions? That's not possible, oh no. And on the other side, well, of course.
Yeah, I think that for a long time, that paradox was what was the hardest for me. You know, really, really feeling like, how could my father have been, how can I remember him as this wonderful, strong, you know, reliable father? How do I reconcile that with his suicide? But then how do I look at the fact that his life ended with this violent, you know, seemingly uncaring toward anyone else action? How do I reconcile that with the fact that he was a loving, you know, he was a loving father? So it really, I think that part of what I do in this book is lay out all of the contradictions and then really accept that the reality includes all of them. and that I'm never going to, there's never going to be one side that wins out, and that accepting the mess is really my job.
And I also felt in the book that there was some anger, well, a lot of anger, as there would be, at a lot of people, but not at him. And I think I read that you felt like you needed to protect him, that the world had found him unacceptable, but you were different, that you were the loving and loyal daughter. Was there ever a point where you became angry with him for what he had done?
Yeah, certainly. You know, as the years went on, and I saw, you know, I saw the impact, the long-term impact of his death on people in the family, including me, including my children, I felt I became more and more angry. But I think what I felt at the beginning was that he had turned such appalling anger on himself that it almost felt disloyal to be angry at him, which is kind of It's kind of a strange thing. And a lot of people would say to me, aren't you angry? Aren't you angry? And I felt like I really wasn't for a long time. And it is strange. I think that there's also a kind of stigma that attaches itself to someone who commits suicide. And that was very painful for me because as his daughter, part of me just wanted to miss him. And I couldn't miss him because he was all tied up now with this act. So people were sort of deploring the act. And I just wanted to miss my father.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a father's suicide and a daughter's quest to understand. We're speaking this hour with Joan Wickersham, author of The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order. You can read an excerpt at our new website, onpointradio.org. Joan, I'm curious, was this book difficult or painful for you to write, or was it therapeutic?
I think it was both. I actually knew fairly soon after my father's death that I wanted to try to write about it because I'm a writer and that's what I do, and also because I thought it's a really important story. I think suicide happens with unfortunate frequency. I've actually read a statistic that says that it happens twice as often as homicide, which is really pretty appalling. And when you consider how often it happens, people don't really talk about it that much. And I wanted to talk about it. I felt like it was an important experience, and I wanted to talk about it. But it took me a long time to find the right way to write about it. I think I tried initially a much more conventional novel approach, which it ended up being very neat and very lyrical. And I feel like suicide ain't neat, and it ain't lyrical, and it just was not true to the experience. And then I tried sort of more conventional memoir, and again, it just didn't do the job. So sort of stumbling on this index format, which takes a chaotic experience and imposes an almost artificially formal structure on it, really allowed the story to come out with the sort of messiness and intensity that it needed to.
It is an unusual and surprisingly effective way. I mean, you write about your father's suicide by way of objects and places at times, you know, garbage bag of his old paperwork, a boat sold to a friendly stranger, the houses that he'd lived in, et cetera. I mean, how did you decide to make that shift to this very unusual style of writing?
Yeah, I think I had to start thinking of his death in terms of individual stories. When I tried to map it out as chronology, you know, that here we were in the mid-80s and here's how things were and here's what the past was like and here's a, it was just too flat and dull and boring. When I grabbed onto particular anecdotes or particular images, suddenly it became this vivid patchwork quilt of all of the fragments that had gone into the fragments that I think really do reflect what family life is like. I mean, family life is nuance. It's stuff that it gets said. It's stuff that doesn't get said. It's messy. And I think that structure worked. And then the suicide itself, it's my response afterward anyway, was to keep asking the same questions over and over and over. And I would think that I had solved something, you know, satisfactorily. And then 2 weeks later, I'd be asking the same question. I mean, even to something like when the passage we just read, where when I first found out about his death, there was a part of me that said, of course. I actually went through a stage a few months later where I became convinced that my father had been murdered because I found envelopes from the police that had the contents of his pockets from that first from the morning, things that were in his pockets the day he died. And the things that were in his pockets were so mundane and so private. And I just thought, how could any man have put this stuff into his pockets and then shot himself 45 minutes later? He must have been murdered. Someone must have come into the house and murdered him. And I had to then go through again, accepting, no, that's not what happened. He didn't get murdered. He killed himself.
You know, the other thing that was so interesting was the routine with which he carried himself the morning he committed suicide. You know, going downstairs, making his wife a cup of coffee, putting it on her nightstand as she was still sleeping in the bed. You know, I mean, it's you can't really make sense of that.
No, you can't. I mean, I think it seems like someone on automatic pilot. I still don't know whether it was someone on whether he was on automatic pilot and then suddenly he snapped and decided to shoot himself, or whether in fact he had made the decision to shoot himself and he was just going through the last few things. I just don't know.
I'd like to add another voice to our conversation here with Joan Wickersham. Joining us now from New York is Dr. Paula Clayton, Medical Director of the American Association for Suicide Prevention. For almost 20 years, she served as professor and head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine. She's also treated many people over the course of her long academic career and has experience with anxious, depressed, and bipolar patients. Dr. Clayton, thank you so much for being here.
Welcome. Hi, Jane.
Hi. What's the most important thing that we should understand about suicide?
Well, I think it's a beautiful, Joan's descriptions are a beautiful description of what happens to families in the wake of this kind of incident. And the thing that actually reconciles the disconnect between the two people is that 90% of people who die by suicide have a mental disorder, are suffering from one at the time of their death. And the most common one is major depression. And the depression that a person feels is so anguished and in such despair that they really see the only way out of this pain, this actual mental pain, is death. And I think if we haven't experienced that ourselves, it's the thing that you have to put into the whole picture.
Help us understand the numbers, Dr. Clayton. How serious of a problem is suicide in this country?
Well, it is the 11th leading cause of death. And in men from the age of 18 to 65, it's the fourth leading cause of death. It actually is highest in men at 85 and older, but there, because they die of so many other things, it isn't as a leading cause of death. The incidence is 11 per 100,000, and it's four times more common in men than women, even though depression is actually more common in women. So there's a kind of inheritable depression that runs in family, or bipolar illness that runs in family, and then there's a kind of another suicide factor that we really don't understand. Mm.
I was interested also to read the numbers related to adolescents and college students.
Yes, it is. It is the second leading cause of death in college students, and the third leading cause of death in adolescents, behind accidents and homicide.
How should one approach a person that they think is at risk of suicide?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you really see a relative or a friend or a student in depression, and which is really down in the dumps, different than they usually are, maybe feeling blue and talking about themselves in a kind of negative way, as well as losing weight or not sleeping and being tired, dropping out of things that they usually enjoy, not reading or not whatever, that you got to say, gee, I'm worried about you. You seem different. Maybe could you be depressed? And they may deny it, and then you have to reconfirm why you think that. And then say, you know, I'd feel better if we just talk to your doctor about it. And then make sure, if you have to go with them, that they talk to someone, either a counselor or their doctor or their psychiatrist.
And you say that that's a really important element because individuals contemplating suicide often don't believe that they can be helped. So accompanying them to the doctor or actually, you know, holding hands as a metaphor is a very important step.
Right, it is. It really is. So that's what I would encourage anyone to do. And we actually make films trying to teach the general public about this. So we're just in the process of finishing a film about depression in high school students that we hope the New York State has paid us to make, and we hope to introduce it into high school students. And it's to describe depression and then to have the kids learn what they look like in themselves or others.
When they're suffering.
Yes.
I want to get to the phones now because we have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Alice first now in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Alice. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, and Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Joan, for writing about this. It's about 20 years ago, in October 6th, 1988, that my father and stepmother suicided together, and he was a doctor, and they did it with pills, and there's so much that you've said that I really resonate to. Like, when did he answer the question, yes? And how terrible it is when people look at you and ask you why. And I had a number of responses to that. The first one was banana pie, because there's no way of knowing. And then I sort of thought rationally, well, maybe he was a late victim of the Holocaust, because his parents had... My grandparents had been murdered in the camps. And then I went to 12-step meetings and heard people say I was so depressed I wanted to suicide, but I didn't have the courage. And I always wanted to walk across the room, slap them hard across the face, and say, the courage is not in checking out. The courage is in sticking around.
Mm-hmm. Alice, thank you so much for that call. You're nodding.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. You hear a lot of similarities in your own story.
I do. And also just I think that thing about just the comments, you know, from well-meaning people who don't get it. And that's part of the problem, too, is that people want to help and they don't quite know what to say. And I think the best thing anyone else can do is just be there to listen if the person wants to talk.
Let's go to Ren, who's on the line now from Holliston, Massachusetts. Hi, Ren. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Much as the previous caller said, resonates. I would offer that depending on when, let me back up here. My mother committed suicide when I was 17. That would have been about 45 years ago. I've had a lot of time to reflect on that, and it was a lot of years before I went into therapy to really be able to reflect on it. But I would offer that depending on the age this happens, you may never get an answer because you're proposing an answer, but you don't have a dialogue any longer. It becomes your job to provide both sides of the conversation, and that leaves you with some very sketchy answers.
Ren, I so appreciate your call. Thank you very much. It leads me to wonder from you, Joan, how you explained this, your father's suicide, to your children. You talk about this in the book. Would you tell us how now?
Yeah. I mean, that was very... My younger son wasn't yet born when my father died. My older son was 3, and he was much too young to understand what had happened, if anyone's ever old enough to understand what happened. But certainly, I debated through his early childhood when and how was I going to tell him, and I debated, you know, at various times, was he ready? How do I do it? You know, maybe it will come up. I thought he would ask questions, and he never did. And finally, when he was about 9, I think, I finally just told him because I thought that the most dangerous thing would be for it to be this big family secret that he found out by accident at some point when he was older. I thought it was important for him to just have it as part of the landscape. But it was awkward. And when you asked me before about times when I got angry at my father, having to tell my child what my father had done was one of those times. Mm. But I also agree with Dr. Clayton that, you know, it's that there's an element of this that's an illness, and you can't get angry at someone who is sick. And so that's part of the paradox as well.
Dr. Clayton, in the aftermath of a loved one's suicide, there is such a need, as we've been discussing here with Joan, to understand why. So what do you say to those children, grandchildren, whomever, who are left behind struggling to understand? We've heard it in the voices of our callers.
Well, I think that you everybody tries to deal with this in his or her own way. Some write about it, some want to read about it, and that's why this book is so excellent. And others really go now online and look for answers there. And that's really what our foundation is about. It's the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. And people can go online, and we have a National Suicide Survivors Day that occurs the Saturday before Thanksgiving every year. And it's an hour and a half program, and we talk to an expert and then interview people who've had a death by suicide. And the one on our line right now has the panel has lost one a parent, another's who lost children and husbands, etc. And so I think that's another way of learning. And I believe the best thing to say if you are the friend is, "I'm just so sorry. He must have really been in pain." I think you just have to express that and let them, as Joan says, let them ask you if you're ready to talk about it.
I want to go to one more call before we have to go to a break here. In Hamilton, Massachusetts, Nina is on the line. Nina, welcome.
Jane, thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
I think that to cut to the chase, my mother committed suicide when I was 6 months old, leaving me and my 6 and 8 year old brothers. Motherless and a father who was chronically ill, and I grew up thinking until I was 11 that she had died of polio. And finally, one day, my aunt, her sister, called us up on Easter and told us. And I can tell you that I understand what happened to hers because I inherited that gene, as have my mother from her father and my father from his mother, the suicidal tendency. And I planned mine for, or at least tried to plan mine for 16 months. And I can only tell you that the pain is so excruciating that that's what you want to do. You just want to end it. And it's physical, it's emotional, and something my husband didn't understand, it is physical. You feel sick or wounded or and you don't taste anything, and you see in black and white, and there is no joy. There is no joy. And when the moment finally came for me, there's clarity. And so for Joan's father, I understand why he could pick up the paper, leave coffee for his wife, and then just go shoot himself, because up until that point, until you're ready, you're nervous, and you don't get the job done. But finally, there is a moment when it's the time. And my husband went through the same jarring wondering, how could I have done this?
Nina, we appreciate so much your call, and we wish you the very best. Thank you very much. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're speaking this hour with Joan Wickersham, author of the memoir, The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order, and to Paula Clayton, medical director of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Joan Wickersham, I wish you'd read a bit more from the book. There's so many powerful stories in here. Tell us the one. Well, you try to inject humor into this as well. It seems a little odd, but it works in the writing. Read us this excerpt.
Yeah, this is just a very short entry in the index, which is called Suicide, Finding Some Humor in Valentine's Day. My mother and I went out to lunch together about a week after my father died, and the waitress asked, "So, did you have a good Valentine's yesterday?" My mother stiffened, managed a shrug. The waitress was instantly alert with sympathy. "Didn't he give you what you wanted?" And my mother said, not exactly.
How did you deal with the uncomfortability? You write about this in the book, the uncomfortability of people who make comments that, may not seem quite right, and the like.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's really hard is that you know when they're saying things, you know that it's well-meaning, and so you want to kind of embrace them for the outreach of it and the intention of it. But it's such a sensitive subject for the person who's gone through it, and it's also such a lonely experience. You really feel like you don't. It doesn't quite align with any other kind of experience. And so it's a tough thing because you have this person who in a way died of intense loneliness, and then that makes you very lonely going through the experience, and then you get even more lonely because you can't even figure out how to get comfort from people around you that really want to give you comfort. And it's a lonely experience. I also have to say that, you know, there were people in my life. My husband was unbelievable because he just was right there with me, and he never tried to impose anything on me. He just accompanied me. And I think that's the other thing, just to try to accompany someone through it.
The other thing that was so genuine, I thought, in this book was your portrayal of the relationship you have or had with your mother, the ups and downs. You're brutally honest. Will you describe that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, it's funny. My mother and I are both, we're both pretty frank, and we both like it right out there. And I think that that was something that continued through my father's death. You know, one of the things that I think happens with a suicide, because there's an embedded mystery in the death, you're constantly trying out your version of what happened. So I come from a family where there were numerous people trying out their version very loudly of what happened. Mm-hmm. And the versions don't always jibe. Mm-hmm. And so my mother and I kind of squabbled our way through it. And I think in retrospect, it was good because we kept talking all the way through it. And, you know, we fight, we make up, we adore each other. It's prickly. And it, you know, in some ways, that didn't change. It wasn't always pretty, and I think I make that pretty clear in the book. But it was vivid and it was real, and it's a close relationship.
Back to the phones now, to Mississippi. Carol is in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Welcome to the program, Carol.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm motivated to call because so many things that Joan said really touched me. I was 33 years married to a very principled man. And it was quite sudden that he took his life. But the one thing that really caught my attention was the understanding. When I came home, and he was carbon monoxide in his case, but when I realized what he did, the shock, and at the same time, the understanding was just unbelievable. I remember those two conflicting emotions hitting me at the same time. And so it was interesting to hear that Joan also experienced that same thing. Another thing that I the anger never came, but I hate now that seeing the damage, the hurtfulness to my sons and to my grandchildren, because it's hard to explain except that it, when someone commits suicide, then the option is there. It's left for others. As horrible as it is, that option is there. And one more thing is that I hate that when people ask me how he died and I have to tell them, which I do quite openly, that defines him, those that didn't know him, and even those that did, and he was just so much more to that than that.
Carol, I want to let Joan jump in, and I appreciate so much your call. Thank you.
Yeah. One thing I actually mention in the book, there's a point where I was going through a dictionary and looking up the word suicide, and I realized that one of the definitions of suicide is a person who commits suicide. And I was thinking about that if you are, someone kills you, you're not called a murderer. And if you die of cancer, you're not called a cancer. But if you die of suicide, you are called a suicide, and so it's like your death becomes your definition.
Back to the phones now. Bob is in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Bob. Welcome to On Point.
Greetings. I had a brother who committed suicide over 10 years ago. He was separated from his family both in time, there had been no contact for over 8 years, and by distance over thousands of miles. one of the things that everyone always wants to know is, you know, was there a note, and how did this happen, and why did it happen? And what I did was, and I encourage, and I want to give encouragement to people who are going through this, to conduct what's called a psychological autopsy. I didn't have a name for what I was doing at the time. I only found out about it after the fact. And what it entails is doing a very meticulous and involved search of every single document and record, financial records, talking to friends, acquaintances, his employers, and try to put together a chronology of this person's last few days of this individual's life.
Did you come up with
and
some
I
answers?
I also recommend that people do a full, if there's a coroner involved or a medical examiner, short of a full autopsy being done, make sure that people do the body fluids are saved and person does has a full toxicology screen done. And this can provide a lot of answers, because along the way, my experience was that there were friends and acquaintances of his who basically stonewalled me, and people telling me, you'll never find out, why are you doing this, why are you playing detective? And you just have to push through that. It took me literally hundreds of hours to put together what I felt was an answer as to why my brother did what he did. Thank you very much.
All right, Bob, thanks. Dr. Clayton, would you respond?
It's interesting that he uses that word, because that is actually how we know that 90% or more of people who die of suicide have a mental disorder. There have now been about 115 such studies of psychological autopsies. The first was in the 50s. And the interviewer goes with a structured interview and interviews all the surviving family members, doctors, records, whatever. And then they meet together and decide what was going on in the immediate hours before the death. And that's where the figure 90% comes from. About 60% of them have depression, and the next most common illness is either alcohol or drug abuse. But then there's bipolar and schizophrenia and anorexia. All of these illnesses can be fatal. And so, and the most common cause of death is suicide.
Joan Wickersham, I want you to read another section of the book. This is a very moving piece, actually, toward the end.
This is from a section of the book that's called Suicide Psychological Impact Of. And this is about being in the airport. And one thing that I think can happen after a death, not just a suicide death, but any death, is that you sort of think that you see the person in the street or whatever. So this is
something of a mirage.
Yeah. So this is a little section that's called He Appears in the Airport. I checked in for my Paris flight and sat in a chair drinking tea and doing a crossword puzzle. I got stuck on a clue and looked around the room. My father was sitting across the lounge at the end of a long row of chairs. He was wearing a suede jacket, reading the Times, waiting patiently for his flight to be called. It was different from the other times when I'd spotted him, in the cheese shop, or sitting a few rows ahead of me at a concert, or climbing slowly out of a parked car as I went by, helplessly, in the passenger seat of a moving one. This time I knew it wasn't him. I was like a veteran of the desert who knows about mirages but can still be stirred by one, capable of simultaneously discounting and savoring the sight of green trees and a pool of clear water. I sat in the departure lounge looking wistfully over at this guy. Not only did I see him, I understood him. He was living a peripatetic life, flying to and from Europe, where he could travel easily, comfortable in the German of his childhood and the French, Spanish, and Portuguese he spoke so fluently. He was living this other secret life because he was afraid to come home. I knew I wasn't going to get up and move closer, but I imagined what might happen if I did. I imagined that he would have looked up to stare at me with uncertain, smiling amazement. His cover would have been blown, but we would both have been relieved that I'd blown it. I would have said to him, "It's okay. You don't have to worry anymore. It's safe. The mess you left has all been cleaned up. You can come home now."
What do you say to that? Does that kind of thing still happen? Do you still envision him or see him?
I don't really anymore as much. I think that there's a way that writing this book and having the time go by, I think has really put it, it never quite gets put to rest, but it's put much more to rest than it was. And I also think the other thing that I wanted to say, which is also partly in response to the last caller, is for me, I think that I needed to go on this quest for answers, but I think that the thing I ultimately had to accept was that I was never going to have a clear understanding of why my father did what he did. I have a clearer understanding, but there's still that fundamental mystery that will always remain. And when people say to me, another one of the things people say to you is, do you get closure? And I feel like you don't get closure, or I didn't get closure, but what I got closure on was I accept the depth of the mystery, and I accept that I will never, ever really know.
Hmm. Let's take another few calls here. Clag is in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Clag. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My grandfather was a missionary doctor in China, moved a whole family from Charlottesville, Virginia, to China in 1908. There were seven siblings, and of those seven, four would ultimately commit suicide, including my mom at 38 in 1957, 8 months after my father died at 42 of a heart attack. And needless to say, the four of us siblings, well, we went through, even in those young years, wondering what we might have had to do with it. That never settled in deeply. I mean, I can look at what went on in those 8 months and, not worry about shouldering blame. But in my later life, as a young man, I certainly had a good deal of rage. And for many years, folks close to me figured that had to do with especially how my mom decided to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not. Mm. Only a few years ago, I finally got around to getting some therapy. We were subsequently brought up by my aunt and uncle, who couldn't have been more different than our parents. And he was a surgeon, and in those days, surgeons did not believe in psychiatry at all. He could have used it himself. He ultimately took his life with carbon monoxide. But so people figured that my rage was at my mom. It was not.
For time's sake, I just have to cut you off, Clegg, and I wonder if you ever found out an answer.
Well, yes. I was just about to say, I felt disappointment. I felt deep sadness. But I also had some empathy and some understanding because I found out about how, you know, what their lives had been like in China and what their lives had been like coming back over here. And so, of course, you can't totally understand it, but
you had empathy.
I have empathy for it. And the last thing I would say is the last thing I would ever do is that. People thinking that it's going to replicate itself never happened. I could see an ICBM come in and I'll jump for cover. I'm going to survive.
Clag, thank you. Thanks for your perspective. I appreciate your story. A couple more here. Deborah is in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to say that two years ago, my 19-year-old niece, my brother's only child, she was a college student, committed suicide. She was a gifted young woman. What I have seen since her death is this kind of romanticization of her suicide by some members of my family. There are poems about suicides, by suicides, kind of little shrines to her. And I have been really worried about the effect that this romanticization has had on my nieces and nephews and even my daughter, all of whom are teenagers.
It's a good question, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but the clock's against me, and I want Joan to respond here. Thank you for the call, Deborah.
I just want to say that I think there can be a romanticization of suicide. I mean, certainly when I was a teenager, I was interested in Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton and those poets and everything. But having been through it as a family member, it is so awful, and it's not romantic. And part of what I was trying to do in writing this book is to de-romanticize suicide and really, really show what the impact is and how messy it is.
Dr. Clayton, would you respond to that point?
I think she put it beautifully. I can't add anything. I am very grateful to her for writing this book, because I think everything that she's saying are points that we've certainly heard and are said better than most of us could do it.
Joan Wickersham, I hope this is not too personal of a question, but I, as we wrap up here, would like to ask you if you could say something to your father now, what would it be?
Well, I think what I would say, if I could get him back, I would say, don't do it. But I also think part of what I accept is that that might in fact deter him, or it might not. And I just don't know. I hope it would, but I don't know.
Joan Wickersham is our guest this hour. Her new book is The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
And Dr. Paula Clayton, Medical Director of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we appreciate your perspective. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast. Read an excerpt from Joan Wickersham's memoir at our new website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.